This is called Chronic Blues. Quite apt, I think, for the times that we're in. John Coltrane is the band leader and the composer on tenor sax. Johnny Splon on trumpet. Sahib Shihab on baritone sax. Mal Waldron on piano. Paul Chambers on bass. And Albert Tootie Heath on drums. This was recorded for the Prestige label in 1957. How about that? That was when Coltrane was awarded the majestic sum by contract of $300 per album, and he was committed to producing three albums a year. Exploitation is amazing. All the way back then in 1957. This is Lead Stories. I'm Beatrice Lead. And we'll be talking about Bernie Sanders tomorrow. He has quit the race, leaving the last man standing, Joe Biden, as the last Democrat basically standing. So there's no question as to who the Democratic candidate will be for president. We'll talk about that tomorrow because there's a lot to say about it. But today I want to talk about the question, can Wall Street, that's where we're headed, to Wall Street, can Wall Street save the U.S. economy? That's it. It has sputtered. It has soared, it has tanked, but the powerhouse financial collective has had and continues to have the unflinching loyalty and support of presidents and legislative bodies, Republican and Democrat alike. In the age of massive coronavirus incentives or stimulus packages to jumpstart the economy, no doubt Wall Street wants its share of the action, and it intends to get it. But can Wall Street save the U.S. economy? We have as our guest, our esteemed guest, someone you are familiar with, no doubt. His name is Charles Ortel. He has been with us for so long, for so many issues dealing with the Clintons and crime in nonprofit organizations, mostly foundations, which is where he has turned his time and energy toward rooting out crime and very unusual operations within the charitable movement. Or charities, I should say. And he has gotten very, very far with that. And we are pleased that he could join us today and talk about this. As an ex-Wall Street banker, he separates fact from fiction. And we are pleased, Charles, that you can join us today.
Well, thank you so much, Beatrice, for letting me come back on.
Letting you come back on, it's a great honor to have you back on.
My pleasure.
Well, in 2010, Congress passed the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act to give the federal government more oversight of Wall Street. But it seems as if Wall Street has reversed the intention of the legislation, arrogating unto itself far more power and control than the government had intended to let it have. What is your view on that?
Yeah, I think there remain vexing, deep problems with the ways in which financial markets pretend that they are regulated. In other words, the regulatory apparatus of even the august U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission is not strong enough to, in quick time, keep up with multinational corporations like General Electric, as one prime example, that operate so many different ways in so many different countries, really outside the scope of effective regulatory oversight. This goes for any major multinational, whether it's U.S. or foreign. The reports are not granular enough to give the public a real sense of what's going on in each company. Regulators are, I think, it might be conspiratorial to suggest that the budgets of regulators are on purpose set at levels that don't allow them to do what they should be doing. But we're in this place where the people who are trying to do the policing are no match for those who might perpetrate abuses. That's on the one hand. The other problem is that going back to 2010 and really to 2008, interest rates that the key interest rates, which I don't want to get too deeply into the weeds, but it's important to cover this. All assets of any kind that have a financial relationship are tied to what's called the risk-free interest rate in the United States for United States investors. That tends to be the interest rate on 10-year government bonds. Those are viewed to be, even with a high level of debts and problems in the U.S., very safe investments, indeed almost risk-free. And so investors look at any other alternative and say, how much of a return do I want in relationship to that risk-free rate that I can get for just buying a U.S. 10-year Treasury bond? In 2008 timeframe, the rate that you could get back then was 5%. Today, the rate that you can get is 0.75%.
Wow. Now,
so markets are trading without the kind of real price discovery that, you know, if we got 1,000 of your listeners together and all had a point of view about a certain stock or bond, we would arrive at our market value. Some people would say it should be 5, some would say 75 basis points or whatever, and we'd work it out, and then the money would change hands and a rate would be set. But when you have one gigantic player, the Federal Reserve or central bank, buying up everything that they might want to buy to try to, you know, give the appearance of stability, you don't have what's called price discovery. You don't really know exactly what you're buying. And markets go all haywire. Now, the problem is back in 2008 and after 2008, Barack Obama's administration and the then central banker, Ben Bernanke, and I think Janet Yellen, they had the ability to lower interest rates dramatically, as they did. Jay Powell, as central bank chief, has been lowering interest rates, but you really can't, it's almost wacky to do what they're doing now. You can't go into negative interest rate territory for long. It's not going to work. And so rather than focusing on the financialization of the economy, which is, I think, the headline of what happened from 89 forward, that smart people coming out of whatever backgrounds they may want to have been involved in were drawn to a Wall Street because you could make so much money, far more money at a young age on Wall Street. I know I was interested in Wall Street for just that reason. I felt I knew something about numbers and was comfortable with financial statements, and I didn't want to be an accountant. And I thought, you know, being an investment banker was pretty cool. And you, by the way, you could make a lot of money before you were 30 if you're lucky. So instead of doing that, I think we're now in a moment, a pause, obviously, with this virus interlude, where politicians in both parties are going to coalesce over the idea that multinationals, particularly American multinationals, should bring their factories and workers back into this country. Maybe not exactly the way we used to make things before, but instead of having, let's say, 10,000 workers in India, human workers in India, maybe we can come back and have 1,000 human workers and a lot of machines do the same sort of things that people were doing for us in India, but do it in Toledo, Ohio, or do it in Poughkeepsie, New York, or do it in places where the inner cities, or for that matter, in Harlem here in Manhattan, do it in places that have been really devastated since 1950. And I think you're seeing in the people around Trump, the Peter Navarros, for example, and the Larry Kudlows, you're seeing people who really genuinely want to do that. I also believe Trump wants to do that. And then, you know, we can, I suppose, forget about Bernie Sanders, but people who liked him, who were on the other side of the aisle from the Trump supporters, they also want to see private sector jobs, not necessarily government jobs, private sector jobs, good, high-paying private sector jobs come back into this country. We're in a moment now in a reset where I think there's going to be political will to encourage that here for a variety of reasons. It's obviously good potentially for the workers inside this country. But when we think about the damage caused by globalization, that is to say, when you take a business like Ford Motor Company, which used to make everything here in the United States, when you have that kind of approach where you make literally every part of the car inside this country, the salaries that are paid to the workers circulate in the local economies of the cities and states where those workers go and buy goods and services for themselves and their families. When you set up a supply chain that has, you know, not very much made here in the United States and maybe just a few things assembled to produce a finished good, you don't have that ripple impact. It's called a multiplier effect. Conversely, when you go back to the older way of doing it, which I think makes a lot more sense, you will create the demand for workers. And I think, you know, you can't do this in a second. It's going to take months, maybe years to get it accomplished. But if you reverse the globalist approach, the globalist supply chain approach, this country will be enormously better off because we have such a vast country. For all our differences, we have legal precedents that go back centuries when you think about, you know, how to invest and how to run businesses. So you're going to create, instead of having a whole bunch of people with calculators and fancy suits doing leverage buyouts and merging companies and doing that, we may now be entering a new era where the people driving the train are sincerely interested in encouraging employment inside this country. And that will be very good if that's true.
Have we been duped all this time by the so-called arguments about globalism and making sure that, okay, you retain some of the production work and you retain some of the value here, but wasn't that a lie to begin with, that the intention was to make as much profit as possible? You throw out of the window anything having to do with workers' rights and a fair salary. The main thing was that whereas you had to pay a U.S. worker $5 an hour, you can pay somebody in India 50 cents a day.
I think, yeah, to call it, what I think is going on inside this country and around the world, and I think it's been going on inside this country going way back. I mean, the first signs of discontent with this move towards globalism, I would argue, was Ross Perot in the 1992 campaign. And we've had a succession of people like that, not necessarily articulating their visions well, but just reacting to the negative consequences of a push, not for globalism, but what they really wanted was unregulated globalism. Instead of having tough national laws, they wanted to set up these grand visions that academics would endorse and consultants would say were wonderful and lawyers would love and corporate-owned media would love. But what they were missing is we were moving from tough laws. I mean, by 1992, there were some pretty tough laws on the books, environmental laws, worker rights laws, et cetera, in the United States. But if you move away from that and you say you can still sell Mr. Multinational Corporation or Mrs. Multinational Corporation inside the U.S., but we don't care where you make the product, then who's going to go check? I'll put in a plug for somebody I don't know. There's a very fine author named Catherine Eban, E-B-A-N, who has explored this issue, the perils of globalization, of rushed, unregulated globalism, in a wonderful book called Bottle of Lies. And it's all about the drug industry. Very timely, now that we try to wrestle with this COVID and the issue that different countries might get their supplies of drugs cut off, since they're manufactured in China and India principally now after 20, 30 years of globalization. That book illustrates vividly for me, and I'm still reading it, but I love it, the perils of a headlong rush by United States regulators to allow this type of stuff and to enrich, as it turns out, people who I think are headed to prison. The Ron Bo- we've talked on your show, Utrice, at length about Ron Boxey. A case study in that book is Ron Boxey, the company that, as Catherine Eban so vividly explains, actually tricked the World Health Organization in 2002. Maybe it wasn't very difficult, but they tricked the World Health Organization into approving versions of their AIDS drugs, or their HIV drugs. And as it turns out in hindsight, none of the materials that had been given to the great World Health Organization that's supposed to be so smart to be tested, none of them were actually Ranbaxy drugs. None of the trials were authentic. It was all a fraud. And yet the World Health Organization endorsed it. So I think this unregulated globalism has been great for the monopolists, you know, the Bill Gates, the Michael Bloombergs, those type of people, great for them. But for people across the political spectrum, whether you're right wing, left wing, if you have a job, I challenge you to do the hard math about how much money are you making in your job in 2020? How many hours do you find yourself working when we get back to work? Because it used to be, I know for me, prior to the internet, you didn't really have to work on the weekend. You put that internet up and running, and suddenly everybody is working 7 days a week if they're trying to get ahead, and yet you're making the same or less money, and the cost of your running your household's going up. And so unless you're, you know, you've got savings and you're making money in the markets, in addition to your salary, you just feel stretched, pressurized, and disenchanted. And you may come at it from a right-wing critique, you may come at it from a left-wing critique, but the unifying theme I think we're going to see here is that people are still dissatisfied with this system of unregulated globalism. And we're even more dissatisfied with the idea of taking, borrowing money or taking taxpayer money to give it to schemes around the world where the people claiming to do good works are in fact either stealing the money or looking the other way as it gets diverted. So,
well, I can't resist it anymore, so I'm going to ask the question. In this regard, what is the difference between the role of President Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and with regard to Ranbaxy, a bogus drug that was supposed to stamp out AIDS, freely and liberally distributed through throughout countries of mostly blacks and non-whites, I should say. What is the difference between them and a Donald Trump, who you say is trying something new?
Well, I think there's a very big difference. So going back into Bill and Hillary Clinton with the HIV/AIDS programs that were supposedly carried out in the name of the Clinton Foundation, as we demonstrated in more than 200 two-hour videos and many interviews with you and other interviews, the Clinton Foundation never had held lawful authority to do any work outside of Little Rock, let alone to promote the sale of a certain type of supposedly useful generic drugs that it turns out were never checked by anybody. And so, you know, that's just a bull. When Bill, here we're dealing with Bill and Hillary's careers after Bill was president. With Trump, I mean, I don't know if Trump, you know, Trump foundations I don't think are doing much at all at this point, and I don't believe they were involved in any international work. Are you talking about the COVID vaccine and drugs? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah. So there, my understanding is, and I'm not very good in the medical area. I'm squeamish. I didn't enjoy dissecting the frog in biology class in ninth grade. So I can't get too deeply into the issue, but my understanding is the drug that Donald Trump and others are suggesting is a useful drug to take if you are, and doctors are suggesting this as well, is a drug that is used heavily I believe, throughout countries where malaria is still prevalent, and taken in combination, obviously under the care of a doctor. I'm not prescribing anything, and I don't, Trump isn't prescribing anything either. Taken under the under the watchful eye of qualified medical professionals, it seems so far that there have been many more cases of patients who were looking at the end, having been diagnosed with COVID-19 and generally having other pre-existing conditions that could lead to their death, that by the introduction of this particular drug, and I'll slaughter the pronunciation, so I won't even try to say it, there's the one anecdotal case of a Democratic legislator who claimed in her case that it turned, she was near death and she's fine now. And, the problem with that anecdotal approach is if you haven't gone through widespread tests, human trials, you could just be a fluke. So you have to go through the type of testing. That I don't think Donald Trump is suggesting that, let's just take any old pill, claim that it's going to work, and make a contributor to his foundation wealthy. I mean, the Rumboxic promoters made billions of dollars personally as a consequence of the Clinton Foundation's promotion and insulation of Rumboxy from the tough oversight it should have gotten. That's, I don't think there's anything close to an analogy with Trump. He was accused of having an investment in a fund that had an investment in a company called Sanofi, which is a very large, I think, French company. But that's preposterous. I mean, that's, any investment he might have had is puny. I checked Sanofi's market value yesterday. It was $200 billion. Donald Trump certainly did not have a meaningful interest personally in that company. And so I think there are major differences, actually.
So much deference is given to the collection of corporations that together form Wall Street. But in your view, has the United States gotten just returns on that investment?
You're talking about the investment made to shore Wall Street up in 2008?
Yes.
Yeah. I think the idea, the contract that was entered into in 2008 and 2009, and now again seems to be entered into, that profits accrue to the benefit of the managers in the years where they make money, but losses get put on the backs of the taxpayer, is repugnant. You cannot have that contract, because what you end up with, now we have two precedents of this. No significant individual went to jail for what happened in 2008 and 9. And that should have happened. It really should have happened. And, now we're going to see, we'll see whether people go to jail, what happened here. But if you lay these precedents down in industries like Wall Street, or in business at large, where it's possible to on the upside, make billions, but on the downside, insulate yourself from losses, you're gonna increase the scam quotient in American life and in life around the world. So malefactors, fraudsters, people who were abusing the system, trading on inside information, profiting in ways they shouldn't have been profitable.
And that includes members of Congress, as we've seen.
Centrally includes members of Congress who are insulated from the risks posed by trading on inside information. It centrally includes them. Those people, that Kelly, whatever her name is, whose husband is the senator who's from, I think, is it Virginia? No, it's Georgia, whose husband was somehow involved in the New York Stock Exchange and is a Republican. She belongs, and there needs to be a serious investigation into her. And if she was trading on inside information, if the law allows, she should be put in prison. I feel very strong that you cannot have a system where connected insiders, you know, learn how to shoot fish out in a barrel, and the rest of us, either individuals or, you know, people in public sector unions and other unions who have pension funds, are being sorely abused by this type of system. We have a unified interest, despite our political, whatever our political affiliation or inclination may be, in stamping out fraud. Fraud is anathema, and whether it be in charities or in the financial market. So, no, I don't think there has been the type of policing of financial markets that there needs to be. Part of that is due to an insidious change that went through in the Clinton administration, which lessened the liability, served to lessen the liability of advisors for their actions. So back when I was on Wall Street, I was a partner at a small firm on Wall Street. The rules were such that you had to keep your capital in the firm, and it wasn't protected by government. And if you had a problem at your firm, it was the partners who personally were liable for losses. And it wasn't a casual conversation about, you know, we sort of would like to have some money from you. Give us your damn money now. So that engendered a more cautious approach and skeptical approach to deal making. When they changed this law to lessen the liability that advisors had when they rendered advice and transactions, and simultaneously moved from, you know, privately owned firms to these large shareholder-owned firms, which weren't appropriately policed, people and management became seduced more easily into these risky schemes that crashed in 2008 through 9, and now seem to be crashing for different reasons in 2020. There needs to be, you know, human being. I actually believe in incentives and punishments, and they work well for humans.
Could you take us back to your particular one-man assignment in which you proved that General Electric was overvaluing its stock? Nobody else did it. No governmental entity did it. And yet, you know, just one guy who insisted that the books are wrong, and there is widespread overvaluation of stock, so that it can be said that GE fraudulently made huge profits. What happened to the case?
Yeah, that was, like a lot that happens in my life, it really was an accident. I didn't wake up one morning and say, well, why don't I really go for GE? I want to punish them. I it was rather the reverse. I had retired at the age of 46 in 2002. I became interested in going back to Wall Street in 2006. To prepare the ground for doing that, I said, you know, it's been a while since I've studied stocks and their values and bonds and things. Let me do a bit of that. Let me focus on 25 companies that are big, multinationals, thought to be great. And let me do a comparison of, you know, who are the better ones and what are the important metrics. And I did. I put GE in the pile of the 25 that I wanted to look at. And I tried, you know, I didn't go on at first. I did, you know, a number of them many of the other ones, and I could do all 24. But every time I tried to understand GE, I couldn't figure out what the hell the financial statements, they didn't make any sense to me. And, you know, I struggled with it for a while, and I nearly thought about just saying, oh, they're impenetrable. At that time, they had the highest possible rating on their debt, meaning the supposedly smart rating agencies thought General Electric was a AAA company, both Moody's and S&P, which is there are very few companies left that are AAA. There might be, I think there are fewer than five private ones. I mean, you know, non-government related American companies. And so I looked at the finance, I looked at the research reports, and I realized that the people who were covering the company were primarily people who liked industrial companies, not people who understood banks. And then I looked at the financial side of the company, and they had reports on the financial side, And I could see, because I understand how to look at banks, that it was a disaster on the banking side. And yet nowhere could I find granular information about the non-banking side until one day I said, well, why don't I simply subtract the financial results from the consolidated results and see what I get as a residual. And lo and behold, that exercise, which was just arithmetic, but a lot of it, revealed for me that it was a disaster, that it was a bad bank hiding inside something that pretended to be a strong industrial company, and that even when you finally teased out what the industrial businesses looked like, their revenues were not rising. Margins were shrinking, and they were sucking. They were not generating cash flow, and I was able to make a very clear and convincing case. But I thought at the beginning, I literally went to a few of my friends and I said, I've been living in upstate New York for now 4 or 5 years. I think I may have gone crazy because I think GE potentially is involved in fraud. And people said, some people joke with me, said, everybody knows you're crazy, Charles. Just getting around a little bit. But I then went to some very senior people I know around the world, and I made my case, and they said, you're absolutely right. And you have to educate the press. So I set about that task. And after February of 2007, I started meeting with people and more people and more people. And then out of the blue in April of 2008, actually before April of 2008, in around the time of the Super Bowl, whenever that was in 2008, GE was a big advertiser. And they had a big Super Bowl ad. And their tagline for GE was and may still be imagination at work. And so what I did in that project is I had a tagline and I said, too much imagination at work, ? Was the title of my presentation. And I was watching the Super Bowl, waiting to see this ad. And next thing I know, there's the music from The Wizard of Oz, If I Only Had a Brain. And that was the theme of this GE Super Bowl ad. I'm like, how did that get through management? That's a ridiculous ad. And I don't think it lasted very long, the ad. And then they missed. In April of 2008, they missed. I've been warning everybody that things are not rosy at General. There's big trouble. And they didn't just miss by a penny. They missed way, way lower than people expected. Once that happened, the major media people started really tearing it apart. And then I went on television September 16th, 2008, the day AIG was seized. And I said, you think AIG is a problem? GE is a much bigger problem than AIG. And I explained that on Bloomberg television. GE went berserk. But within 10 days or so, GE suspended their dividend and had their ratings cut. And the rest is history. It's never been the same.
Do you believe in this period that we're in with the coronavirus and the effort by the Trump administration to kind of re-kickstart the economy, that some of this is going to come along with it, that there will be fraud, that there will be an attempt in order to prove the superior approach that the the president is taking in trying to rebuild the economy, that a lot of things are going to be flying under the radar. Do you expect that is happening?
Oh, absolutely. I think what this is doing, I can't think of, the average family being cooped up together now, what are we, almost 4 weeks into this? Three weeks now, maybe four. This has never, to my knowledge, happened since maybe World War II. We have been afflicted, whether you're in the market or not. Behavior patterns are going to change in consequence of this. Maybe people will go back to spring breaking, in the middle of a contagious pandemic, but or maybe people are going to change their risk profile and say, you know what, I don't think I'm going to borrow to get that car or borrow to buy that house or buy so much on my credit card anymore, and maybe I better start saving money. So you're going to see changes in behavior that are going to affect people's interest in buying goods and services, and it's going to take a while to get through that. I don't believe that you're going to see, I mean, once you tell a group of workers that they're not needed for 6 weeks, some of them disperse. Some of them just can't wait, you know, for the restaurant to reopen. They just try other things. Some leave the country if you can. So these are wrenching disturbances. We don't yet know how long it'll be until it's safe to go about business as usual, particularly here cooped up in Manhattan in New York, and we're in New York City. So, and we're already, we can't change the date. I mean, today is April 8th. I just got, for example, from the dean of my business school, a blast email begging we graduates of this business school to hire Harvard MBAs, that they're having difficulty finding any. And that tells you something. I mean, I remember when I was my second year, I really needed to graduate and get a job to start paying my loans back. And now you've got a situation where schools are, higher universities are so expensive, probably are not getting as many job offers for their students. You have commencements being canceled. Summer's upon us. And then you'll have a new crop of graduates to think about next year. I mean, so there's certain changes that are going to be monumental. Offsetting these negatives, you hear signs of it. I mean, there's signs that American companies are shutting down in China and returning to the United States. I mean, you could have some of what we're going through blunted by efforts to encourage American-owned and backed companies to bring their workers back here. So you could have some of that offsetting. But we're here now at a period where interest rates are very low. So it's not like you can start paying people to borrow money. You don't have as much flexibility as you did back in December 2008 to kickstart by lowering interest rates or kickstart by running big deficits. Because after all, we do have a lot of debt. So I think on balance, 2020 is going to be a rough year economically. But compared to the rest of the world, we're going to be in a lot better shape than most countries.
Are you comfortable with the process so far as it appears in terms of shepherding this shift through? We have the president promising a brighter day, and hopefully with that, more and careful regulation of Wall Street, but I don't see that that's part of what it is he expects to be doing. Are you comfortable with the fact that this major shift is about to take place, but we don't see the infrastructure to monitor how this shift is going to take place?
Well, I would say I'm not comfortable at all, and I wouldn't actually say the biggest culprit is Wall Street here. I think, you know, what I'm not saying that because I used to work on Wall Street. I think the vast trillions of dollars have been wasted by governments around the world, including ours. I mean, you think about the amount of money, I've got actually some friends and allies putting these numbers together, the amount of money that has been raised in the names of the poor, suffering people of Africa in the last 40, 50 years is an astounding figure. So go across these poor countries today. Where are the roads? Where's the electricity? Where is the clean water? Where is all that? What happened to all this money? So I don't think it's simply Wall Street. I think it's a broader question of, if you want to raise money, you want to say that our taxpayer dollars are going to help inner city schools, show us the schools, show us the materials, show us, you know, the progress. What's really going on here? It's an accounting for all, not simply Wall Street. And yes, there are abuses on Wall Street. And yes, there are corporate abuses. There are also, as we've discussed at length, abuses involving charities. I won't pick on this person by name on your broadcast, but there's a person who appeared on CNBC this morning who is very well known whose charities' financials are shambles, seriously getting airtime on CNBC because he believes that he should be close to a Marshall Plan for America, meaning trillions and trillions of dollars to go to this charlatan, you know, with a horrible track record, who can't even run a very small charity. So I think there's charity scam artists. I've done a bunch of videos with our friend Jason Goodman walking around New York City the last three Sundays. You can see those on Sunday with Charles playlist on YouTube, the Jason Goodman channel. And the number of people who are, you know, sketchy people who are either engaged in criminal activity or going to start suggesting that they know how to get money for you and prey upon the vulnerable. That is the worst sort of human behavior, unfortunately, we're seeing through this. But on balance, three, four weeks into this, the American spirit, at least here in Manhattan, seems strong. And I hope we'll get through this. But no, I'm not comfortable with the shift. I'm also not comfortable in general with running my life relying on a financial model. In this case, you know, the model for this COVID disease. That is not the way you should live your life. Models are only as good as the numbers that go into them and the construction of them. This model has been horribly wrong. It fanned, you know, fears, I think perhaps unnecessarily in the beginning. The deaths so far that are being tabulated, you know, no death is pleasant. And I grieve for the people who have lost loved ones because of this, but the levels are not at a level so far high enough that should have triggered the shutting down of the global economy, as far as I can tell.
Charles, it's evident that we will have to have you back as soon as possible this week, because I'm sure we have a lot of people wanting to ask you questions. But this was very instructive, and it allowed you to, you know, stretch out and give us the answers in the way you wanted to give us the information. So I'm thankful for that, and I'm hoping that we can soon have you right back, perhaps the day after tomorrow, if it's workable in your schedule, so that people can ask you questions.
For you, anything.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much. So let's wrap up by asking the question I asked at the outset. Can Wall Street save the U.S. economy?
You're asking me that question. I don't think it's Wall Street. I think it's recharging Main Street that's going to save the American economy. It's making it easier for people to grow the small businesses of this country. That is going to turbocharge this economy. There's at this moment, I mean, you can't promote merger and acquisition transactions, or merger transactions are in the main job killers. You take two businesses together and you eliminate redundant people. What we need to do is promote the growth of our, particularly small businesses, make it easier for them to grow, encourage the hollowed out cities that used to be, New York State used to be the manufacturing capital of the world. It's today a joke for manufacturing. There is no way a sensible person would decide to commit large amounts of money to grow manufacturing here in New York. Just there's so many obstacles to doing it properly. So a thoughtful plan to promote small business opportunities by encouraging these multinationals to bring jobs home, that I think could work very well indeed. But Wall Street, you know, I'm not relying on Wall Street myself to lead the way here. I think it's more people who can come up with a better product or service, figure a way to sell it to our fellow citizens and around the world. That's the way forward here, not bankers, in my view.
Do you think that President Trump would listen to this, it's basic reasoning, but it's smart reasoning and it makes sense? But we are presented with an entirely different attitude that Wall Street we have to protect Wall Street and give Wall Street what it needs. And Wall Street would be the kind of pilot for this new dawn of American entrepreneurship and making money in business and so forth. So I'm pleased to hear your answer, because I think it is right on the mark that the effort has to be made to encourage smaller businesses and to diversify their services for customers who will support them because they need these services. So I'm thrilled that seems to be your answer. I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No, you feel free. That's what I thought I said, but
that in fact is what you said. So Charles, I want to thank you so much for giving your time so generously, as you always have. And let's see if we could arrange for the question session, which would be totally questions, sometime this week, as soon as we can arrange it.
Sounds good, Yatrice. Thank you.
And thanks for being on the air with us today. That brings us to the end of our program. I hope it was informative for you, and I hope it gave you a whole other point of reference on this matter of where is our economy going? What is the proper approach, the most meaningful approach, the most sensible approach? And we can see how far astray the administration appears to be with regard to these premises that we've been talking about today. So stay tuned for us. I'll talk to you tomorrow to confirm when Charles can next be on, and hopefully you can get your questions answered fully then. Thanks for your patience, and thanks for tuning in. Bye-bye.